all the people that came and participated. It's a very exciting topic, and we have a very, very special lecturer, a great scholar in Talmud Chacham, who's well known to many of us, and those that do not have the delight of hearing Rabbi Weinberg. It's very special to facilitate that, to give you the opportunity to share Rabbi Weinberg past the cannabis community. And Rabbi Weinberg hasn't been here for very long, but has already endeared himself to the KMS membership and many other people in the greater Washington area, and it's very special for us to bring him to you in this venue. This topic, I want to speak about it very long because everybody's anxious to hear what Rabbi Weinberg says, but I just want to share a story that somebody told me, I think, that highlights maybe some of the issues. I had the opportunity to host a dentist from California, from L.A. He belongs to the board of the California Dental Association, and he comes here twice a year to lobby as part of the dental lobby, and he stays by my home many times. And he told me he was driving in L.A. in a taxi cab, and the taxi cab, there was a big demonstration against Uber at the time, and he was took the opportunity to complain about Uber and how they're taking away jobs and cutting his parnassa. And he went on, and the dentist was listening patiently. And then the cab turns to the dentist and says, "By the way, what do you do?" So he says, "I'm a dentist." So he says, "Oh, I go to Mexico for my dentistry." So we each have a perspective. There are winners and losers in each kind of different situation, and often they need to be arbitrated, and of course by halacha. So, without further ado, it's very special to have Rabbi Weinberg. It's a great delight for us, and wait for you to be excited. Okay.
I'm going to speak without the mic. If you can't hear me, please let me know, and I'll try to transfer to the mic. I was saying to Rabbi Winter, it's very unnatural. I'm used to speaking on Shabbos. It's unnatural to speak into a mic, so I'm more comfortable like this. Thank you so much. Really, it's an honor and privilege to be here. Thank you to the Kollel and to Young Israel Shomrei Emunah for hosting this event and for inviting me here to speak. I think this is really a great moment. Really a great moment of unity, bringing the KMS rabbi into Shomrei Emunah to an event sponsored by the Kollel, and bringing people from all different walks of life here together this morning. And I think it's unity that's so desperately needed during these difficult times for the Jewish people. And I think it's a very inspiring thing to be here together this morning, and I thank you for coming. I'll share one brief thought on the idea of unity before we go forward with the Uber lecture. You notice that Chazal mentioned on this week's parsha that Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov referred differently to the Makom, the place of the Har HaBayis. And if you look in the Sukkim, Avram seems to refer to it as a har, as a mountain. Yitzchak seems to refer to it as a sadeh, a field. And Yaakov refers to it as a bayis, Beis Elokim, as he refers to it in this week's parsha. So Chazal distinguished between these different metaphors that are used, and saw a beautiful idea that perhaps these three metaphors, the Nativ says, actually symbolize different things that Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were looking for in their relationship from Hashem at different moments in their lives, different moments of their experiences. So Avram, as a newcomer to the land, was looking for Har. What's a Har? Har is a strategic location where you look down upon others. He was looking for military assistance, for protection from Hashem. Hashem is called Magen Avraham. He's the one who supports and protects Avram. Avram was looking for protection. Yitzchak says Sadeh. Sadeh is representative of our sustenance, our economic well-being. Yitzchak was already settled in the land. He wanted Hashem to give him the fortitude to be able to continue there. But Yaakov is the one who's going out into Chutzlaret, going out into the diaspora outside of Israel. And he says this is a bias. A bias, says the Nativ, is symbolic of shalom, of peace, of unity. It's a house that brings people together. And the Nativ says that what Yaakov realized in that moment was, as he was going into exile, so to speak, that the most important thing to keep his family together to keep the future Jewish people together was not necessarily military protection, was not necessarily economic protection, but shalom, after unity, to be able to come together as a family and stick together as a family through thick and thin. And it's a beautiful way to do that here this morning, and our hearts and thoughts are with those in Israel, of course with the Schwartz family in Sharon, Massachusetts, who this afternoon will unfortunately be burying their son Ezra, who was so brutally murdered on Thursday, as many of you know. Hearts and thoughts, our hearts and minds are with everybody at this time, and we pray for their well-being. So, now let's go to Uber. Some of you, I think, are here today because you love Uber, use Uber, and want to know whether it's halakhically permissible, whether it's ethical or not. And I've already told all of you, don't worry, I'm not going to author using Uber today, and you'll be able to use it again. I think some of you here have never heard of Uber before and are here just because you want to hear a nice cheer, and some of you fall somewhere in the middle. And therefore, I thought I would give a little bit of an introduction as to what Uber really is and how it works, and then move to some halakhic discussion of the issues that might be involved with it to give us a perspective on the ethics of using Uber, of Uber itself. Of course, it's not a shiur in halacha l'maisa. There's no necessarily practical stuff that comes out of this shiur that you can ask your local rabbis, but this is really to elucidate some of the issues behind the use of Uber. So Uber is this real, I would say, powerhouse company. It's really changing the whole transportation industry very, very quickly. I think Uber is both wildly successful and wildly contested. And I'll come back to that in a moment about exactly why. But for those of you who don't know, Uber is a technology that was developed. It's an application that you can have on your smartphone that helps people get rides from one place to another. That's one of the uses of Uber, the main use of Uber, to get rides from one place to another, circumventing the normal channels that a person would use, such as a taxi or other modes of transportation. So how does it work if you have never used it before or have never successfully used it before? From the passenger perspective, you get this free application on your smartphone, if your smartphone supports the application, and you load all of your information, your credit card number and everything else, and it has it stored. And when you're looking for a ride, you log into your account, and you set where you want to be picked up from and where you want to go to. And the application will actually list for you the approximate fare. If you look at the picture, the screenshots here at the bottom of the page, I didn't do these on my own phone, this is from the internet, but you set pickup location, that's the first picture, it gives you a little map, it shows you where you are, so you can just say, pick me up right here, you don't even have to know the address where you are, or you can say, you know that, you know, in 5 minutes from now I'm going to be down the street, I want to be picked up at the corner, for example, and therefore you can set that location, and you set the location where you want to go to. The next screen shows you where you're coming from and where you're going to, and it tells you the approximate fare, you choose what kind of car you want. The fares depend really on different traffic patterns and weather and other things like that, but it gives you an approximate fare, and it gives you the picture of the person picking you up, gives you the brand name of their car, and the color of their car, tells you when they're coming, how long they're going to take to get there, and it gives you a little map to show you where they are in respect to you and how they're coming. So I once took an Uber here from Kosher Pastry Oven to the airport. So I set, you know, I logged in and I asked for a pickup location here, my current location, going to DWI, and I said they were 5 minutes away or whatever, and I watched the guy on my phone, I watched him drive down our pole, I saw when he turned onto Lamberton, and then I saw as he turned into the parking lot over here, as he passed the shul, and I knew which car I was looking for, so I spotted him and was able to flag him down, got in the car, and went to the airport. Of course, another time I took it, had a bit of a less successful trip. As I told the guy that I was going to Reagan, and instead he took me to BWI. So that did not end very well. So that was actually my first Uber experience, but it did not turn me off to its usage, but might highlight actually some of the dangers of Uber and some of the downsides of it, which we'll get to a little bit later. So that's really from the passenger perspective. And then the most important part is that there's no money exchange. At the end of the ride, it shows you, see the last screen, it shows you how much you're being charged, it gives you the receipts, it should also email to you, and it automatically deducts it from your credit card, so you don't have to have any cash on you, you don't even have to have your credit card on you. Your kids, for example, could log into your Uber account, they don't need to carry your credit card if they're going from place to place, and they can safely get there without transacting any money in the car with the driver.
What about a tip?
You can add a tip. Gives you different amounts. You can do all of that on your credit card through the application on your phone. From the driver perspective, of course, you know, how does the driver get to be connected to this whole network? So drivers, some of them are doing this full-time, like a taxi service. Some of them are not. I know a person who works about 15, 20 minutes away from, actually more than half an hour away from his house, and he realized that every day on his way home from work, he was driving by himself. And instead of driving by himself, he could make a few dollars by transporting other people. So he signed up and became an Uber driver. And every time he would go home from work, he would log in, say he was available to drive, and therefore if someone in the area was looking for a ride over there, he could accept that as a job, and he could take the person and make a few dollars on his way home. So people are doing this in all different ways for all different reasons, and really work almost like a contractor, which is one of actually the critical issues in the discussions of Uber, which maybe we'll get to very, very briefly at the end, but one of the critical issues both in halacha but also in the general discussions of Uber is whether the employees are treated as employees or contract workers. Are they employees of Uber or are they just contract workers, which of course has very important ramifications in both. And another important piece of the driver is of course they're picking you up in their own car. They don't drive in general. Of course there's many forms of Uber. I'm just talking about the most common forms of Uber right now. They're driving you in their own car as opposed to in a taxi. So it's been wildly successful. Uber was developed in 2009 in San Francisco. They started to launch it in 2010, beta format, but in 2011 it really came out for usage in San Francisco, quickly spread to other cities, to New York, to D.C., to Chicago, eventually to Philadelphia and to other places. In 2012 it went international. I think the first city was Paris, and then eventually London, Toronto, Singapore, Sydney, all around the world. And this month, November 2015, Uber is now the 48th most powerful company in America. It's worth $50 billion. And I think it's operating now in 58 cities in 300 countries around the world. So in different... So that doesn't make sense. Thank you. Thank you for... It's been a long weekend. So anyway, it's spreading like wildfire, and of course many cities are contesting it. It's a wildly contested technology and a wildly contested usage, contested by governments for a variety of reasons. It's contested by taxi companies for obvious reasons, encroaching upon their livelihood. Major protests all around the world. In many cases, the protests have been unsuccessful for a variety of different reasons, but sometimes more successful than others. Some people are actually comparing this. The reason why some governments are opposed to it is because, of course, it's a completely unregulated industry, and therefore neither the drivers nor the passengers are really protected. The drivers don't get the benefits that they would get. They can't join a union, and the passengers really don't have the same recourse as they would if they were taking a taxi that's regulated and licensed, etc. So actually some people have compared Uber to a modern day equivalent of the sweatshop, a place where people could do all kinds of things. Of course it's not a perfect analogy in any way, but in many ways some perhaps an inappropriate analogy, but some people are doing that because really there are some similarities in the fact that it's an unregulated industry that could take advantage both of the passengers and the drivers. So take a look here, for example, on the right-hand side of your page. This is just something I found on timeline.com from a few weeks ago. I cut off the top line. It said, "Is Uber a pioneer in the sharing economy that boosts livelihood and gives people safe rides home, or a felon employing disruptor that puts customers in harm's way and bullies critics out of its path?" Since launching in 2010, Uber has been called both. There's dangers, there's benefits. Across the globe, the ride-sharing service has whisked countless people out of the rain, kept tipsy drivers from getting behind the wheel, but cabbies complain that the $50 billion giant has put them out of business and had put passengers in danger, the two most heavily lobbied critiques against Uber. Some governments and politicians have sided with the taxis. Others, notably New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, sided with Uber As pushback is mounted, Uber has hired an army of lobbyists to smooth its path, also learned a thing or two about public relations, so they really have an arsenal of people fighting for their case, which makes it very difficult to tackle them. Just this week, I wanted to show you in the next page, this past week, there was a suit in New York City. Taxi owners and lenders on Tuesday, this past Tuesday the 17th, sued New York City and its Taxi and Limousine Commission, saying the proliferation of the popular ride-sharing business Uber was destroying their businesses and threatening their livelihoods. The lawsuit filed in Manhattan federal court accused the defendant, Uber, of violating yellow cab drivers' exclusive right to pick up passengers on the street by letting Uber drivers who face fewer regulatory burdens pick up millions of passengers who use smartphones to hail rides. So one of the main complaints is this is in a place like New York, with taxis being regulated and having licenses, is actually illegal. It's not something we're going to deal with here today, exactly, the legalities of it, but it's an interesting perspective as well. Just read the next paragraph, which I think is fascinating as well. According to the complaint, the number of Uber rides in the core of Manhattan increased by 3.82 million from April to June of 2015. Huge. Compared with the year earlier, while medallion cab pickups fell by 3.83 million. So almost exactly correlated, that Uber is really literally stealing the customers away from the taxi industry. So that's a little bit about Uber. Uber is not just a company, it's really a culture. It's a culture that's growing and ever expanding, not a culture that's dying at all, and really shaping the industry and displacing taxis and other forms of transportation. Hence the term disruptive technology. Many people ask me when they saw the title of this year, what is disruptive technology? So if you look on the first page here, to the left, disruptive technology is one that displaces an established technology and shakes up the industry or a groundbreaking product that creates a completely new industry. It's actually a term that was coined by Harvard professor Clayton Christensen in his 1997 very famous book, The Innovator's Dilemma. He categorizes two forms of technology, sustaining technology and disruptive technology. Sustaining technology is a technology that makes slow incremental improvements to already existing technology. That's like basically the method taken by big companies who spend a fortune to develop a certain technology. They're not going to all of a sudden want to throw it in the garbage and start all over again. They're going to want to work with what they have and continue to develop it. Disruptive technology, on the other hand, is like you just read here, something that displaces old technology, trying to replace it with something completely new. And really, the Uber cultures, like the Uberization of America, there are demands now for Uber-like technology to be used in so many different realms. Just heard a couple of weeks ago that Amazon started this thing called Amazon Flex. So Amazon, instead of saying now that you can order it for next day delivery if you pay a lot of money, or two-day delivery if you have Amazon Prime, now there's Amazon Flex, which means that they're going to send products to various distribution points around the country. And Amazon is going to utilize Uber to see who might be driving in the area who would want to deliver the package, and you'll be able to get it in an hour and 2 hours in the same day. Incredible use of this technology. People want to use it for food, for groceries, for other goods and services. So this is really an up-and-coming industry and a cutting-edge topic. There are some fascinating legal questions and halakhic questions that pertain to Uber, and I don't pretend to be an expert in Uber. I don't pretend to be an expert in business ethics at all, or even in Choshen Mishpat, but I thought that this was a fascinating topic that's really Olal Shulchan Malachim. It's really right here in the forefront of legal discussions, of halachic discussions, and it'll be very important today to really uncover and to elucidate some of the halachic issues and questions behind it. There really are two of the core questions that arise in the discussions of Uber in general. Are one, the aspect of competition, is this stealing business away from the taxis? And number two, are the drivers, employees, or contractors, as I mentioned before. So I'd like to focus on issue number one for the majority of the rest of today's share. That's the idea of Hasagas Gvul. Is it forbidden to have competition between businesses in halacha? Is it forbidden to steal away someone else's business? And begin to talk about that in the context of Uber, which poses some very challenging and interesting questions about how to apply classic models of competition in Hasagas Gvul to a brand new environment that doesn't necessarily fit those paradigms. So So we're going to begin here with the Mishnah in Bava Basra, page 2 of your sheet, source number 1. Mark this source number 1. Mizikin in general, of course, deals with torts and damages. Bava Basra in specific deals with property rights and transactions. And this Mishnah is dealing with the rights of different residents of a courtyard to restrict the businesses of the other members of that courtyard. Before we actually begin the Mishnah, just look at the diagram on the bottom. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this already, but in case you're not, in Halacha, there are various realms and domains, and this has an effect in Choshen Mishpat, in business law, but also, of course, in Hilchos Shabbos as well, where it has the most impact. So if you look, this is the setup of the ancient street. You have houses on both sides. You have two houses on the left, two houses on the right. The houses then share a courtyard called the chaser, and then that shared courtyard called the chaser opens up into a mavoy, which is the alleyway that is shared by multiple courtyards, each containing multiple homes. And then that alleyway called the mavoy exits into what's called the Rishus HaRabim. That's really the public thoroughfare. So there's actually four different areas of domain that are contained in this diagram or contained in Halacha. There's the most private of the domains, which is the homes. There's the least private of the domain, which is the public thoroughfare, and there's the two in between. There's the chaser, which is semi-private. Two, three houses at most share that area, and then the mavoy, which is shared by a whole neighborhood of people, but not necessarily the whole city. And then you have multiple mavos, multiple setups like this, which make up a town or a city or a larger neighborhood. Okay, so the Mishnah here says as follows. Chanush b'chaser, a store that's in the chaser, meaning shared by two homes or three homes. Yachol limchos biyado velo marlo, ein yachol lishon mikol hanichnasim mikol hayotzim. If someone opens a store in the chaser, the other members of the chaser, the courtyard, can complain and say, we can't sleep because of the sound of the customers coming in and out of the courtyard. Next case. And therefore they can restrict the person from opening the store. So this is too disruptive to our courtyard. You cannot open your store over here. Aval ose kelim yoto mocha b'toch hashok ve'eno yachol limchos v'yado v'lo marlo eno yachol lishon lo mikol ha'patish v'lo mikol ha'rechayim v'lo mikol ha'tinokos. On the flip side, however, it says, if a person wants to manufacture things in the courtyard and then go sell them in the shuk, in the marketplace, then there's no customers coming in and out of the courtyard, so they won't be disturbed by the customers, but they might be disturbed by the noise. But they cannot make a claim against the one who opened the manufacturing place in the courtyard and say, I can't sleep because of the sound of the hammers and the sound of the mill and the sound of the tinokos. The baby is the big question what that means over here, but putting that aside, I can't sleep with the sound of crying children either. Means I haven't slept in a few years. Be that as it may. Okay, so we see two cases. There's a lot of questions on this Mishnah. Actually, this is not the Mishnah I want to focus on. There's a lot of questions here about why people could protest that the noise of the customers going in and out is bothersome, and therefore they could prevent the business from opening in the chut there. But they can't say that the noise of the hammers and the mill and the manufacturing plant is bothersome enough to prevent the person from opening.
So there's no noise regulation in
Halacha? That's a good question. Not for today, but that's a big Bava Basra question in general. We'll get back to that perhaps, because I think it is related here, what zoning exactly is. So there's a lot of questions about the Mishnah. The Rishonim understand it in different ways. Splitting between these two cases, some Rishonim say the difference between case number one and case number two is in case number one, the noise is really of people from outside the chaser, strangers who are coming in to your chaser, and therefore you can protest against it. But the noise of locals doing their own thing, even manufacturing, that you can't protest against. That's the distinction some people make. Others make different distinctions over here. Maybe in the original case, the sound of customers going in and out is not really disruption of sound. It's actually just the disruption of the traffic that clogs up the chaser. So for whatever reason, these two cases are brought. Actually, in the end of the day, the Gemara here, actually specifically Abaye, and the Gemara on this Mishnah, which I didn't bring over here, concludes that the second case, the Seifa of this Mishnah, the case where you cannot protest someone opening a manufacturing plant within the chatzer because of the noise is not actually a case within one chatzer. It's saying that the people of the other chatzer across the mabui cannot protest about the noise in the chatzer across the mabui in that way. So actually within a chatzer perhaps they could protest, making it very similar to the case, the first case, whereas if it's from a different chatzer they couldn't. But the reason this is important for us is because this is what gets the Gemara into discussion of what might be permissible or not permissible to protest against within the context of a mabui, within the context of this neighborhood or this alleyway. So clearly, from Abaye's reading of this case of the Mishnah, would you say that people of a mabui, people of a neighborhood, could protest against each other because of noise and block the entry of a manufacturer or not? No. Correct. Noise would not be grounds to block someone from coming in to the mabui. Okay. But what about other things? Could other things be blocked, such as business that competes with another? That's how we get into our topic here. So the Gemara, really, one daf later, go to the next page number 3, opens up with this very question. Unlike the case of noise in the Mishnah, there are other cases where someone could block a business, a manufacturer, something else, from coming into the mabui on different grounds. So we begin here. This is the Gemara I really want to focus on for the majority of the share. I could give you really the bottom line of the Gemara in 2 minutes, but I think it's important to go through it. Every line here in the Gemara, every case in this Gemara, actually has many ramifications and many interesting angles to think about in terms of our discussion of competition and Uber, etc. So we'll go through the whole Gemara together. Gemara opens, Amar Rav Huna. Rav Huna says the following halacha. Rav Huna is, of course, an Amora, second generation Amora. Hai bar mavoa, the oki recha, va'ata bar mavoa chavre, the kamoki gabe, dinahu, the ma'akev, ilave. So if one person in the mabui, in this neighborhood, in this alleyway, opens up a mill, and someone else comes in the same mabui and opens up another mill, the first guy can block him from coming in and opening up his business, because he could say to him, you've prevented me from earning my parnasa, from earning my livelihood. You've encroached upon my business in an unfair manner. So Rav Huna actually takes a restrictive view, restricting the free market in this mabui, saying that not anybody can just open a business, but people can restrict each other from opening them up. The Gemara tries to bring support to Rav Huna's statement. Lema Misayile, let's suggest perhaps that we could bring support from the following teaching. Lema Misayile is the way, Gemara's way of saying, we're going to try to introduce the support to the halacha we just learned, but this support is going to be rejected. Might have thought that it would be a good support, it would fit the case, but then ultimately we realize it's not. So what's the support? Marchikim mitsudos hadag, min hadag, kimelo ritas hadag. So if you look at the next page for a second, source number 3, Rashi comments here on this case. What is this case all about? It says, marchikim mitsudos hadag, you have to distance the net, the catfish, from the fish, the amount of space that the fish could swim kind of in one shot, Ritsa Tada. What is this talking about? Look at Rafi. Second line in Rafi. Rechikim, Marchikim, Mitsura Tadag Minadag. Sayat Shinatan Eina Vidag, Atehikir Choro. If a fisherman is very astute in watching the fish every day, knows where they're swimming, finds the lair of the fish, knows exactly where they're going to go back to every time, and therefore what does he do? He sets a trap, he sets a net with food, with bait, knowing that the fish is definitely going to swim in this direction, and when he's swimming in this direction, he's going to be attracted to the bait and go into the net, he's going to catch the fish. The Sayyid Shinatan Enav Bidaga Shahikir Choro, Marchikim Shark Sayyadim Meshudasa Misham, the other fishermen who catch on and say, hey, wait, if this guy found the lair, he's setting the net, I want to set my net too, they can't set their net close by to the net that was already set up by the first fisherman. They have to distance it a certain way. Alma afa gad de lo zafa bay, de lo mata liyade, marchiki misham. Damale kapasak de lichiyuti. So you might think that this case is a support to the case of Rav Huna. Why? Because even though the first fisherman never actually caught the fish yet, Not in his hand yet. Not like someone is coming and actually stealing it from him. Right? The fish is swimming around. You might say to yourself, well, I set a net here, you set a net next to me, and wherever the fish goes. It's a free market society. So you might say that, but nevertheless, this case says that you can't do that. You have to distance the net, even though the fish is not caught yet. So similarly, you say this supports the case of Rav Huna. Rav Huna says that in a mabui, even though the first guy opens the mill, doesn't have any monopoly over the customers coming to him, he doesn't have them in his net, still another person cannot open a mill in the same mabui because it would constitute a breach of this halacha, and it would violate the person's ability to really make a parnasa. Kapasasi v'chiyusa. You're stealing away my livelihood. So, sorry? Oh. Okay. So, it seems like they're in consonance here. So how does the Gemara reject this? The Gemara rejects it saying, Shiny dug him, the Ahave Siyara. But this case is a little bit different. As opposed to customers who come into a neighborhood and they see two mills or two stores and they can make their choice, you know, no particular business owner can trap a customer and say, you have to come to my store. Of course they could, but that wouldn't be the normal way that people would operate. A person could come, even if yesterday and the day before they went to this shop, the next day they might go to that shop, depending on the merchandise, depending on the sales. There are choices that a customer could make. The fish case is not like that. The fish is considered to be caught even before the first fisherman catches it, because fish are said to set their eyes upon the food that they're going to go after. Okay? So the Gemara says, Shiny dug into Yahweh Siyar. They look at the food, they see the food, they're considered caught already. So this is a much more serious case. If someone else comes with another net and essentially steals away the fish that the other guy, technically, halachically speaking, has already caught, that's a bigger breach than in the case of the Mavoy, where Rav Huna says that people have free choice and they can make a choice between one mill and the next, between one store and the next. And even in that case, Rav Huna would say that they have to restrict the business. Okay. So, of course, this doesn't oppose Rav Huna, but it's not necessarily a support for it, because the one who stated the fish case might not agree in Rav Huna's case. In Rav Huna's case, where it's not as serious a breach, they might suggest that, indeed, two people could open a mill within the same neighborhood, and maybe the fish case was different. Any questions up till now? Any thoughts on the fish case, the Mavoy case? Keep the fish case in mind. This is going to become important. Yes, so.
Person that opened the mill
originally. Yes.
He also has trapped customers. Maybe he advertised. Maybe they know
to
go to this guy.
Great. Next case in the Gemara. We're going to get to that right now. Okay. Thank you. I told you you should have given the share today. Yeah.
I don't want to jump ahead, but it seems like you're pointing directly at the fact that the fish, in a way, are instinctive. They don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Kind of. Could say that. I don't want to focus too much on the choice aspect. It's a fine point here between the Mavoy and the fish, and we can come back to that perhaps afterwards when we round out all these cases. Maybe we'll come back to that. Yeah. Okay. Any clarification questions? Because I want to go on with the cases. Okay. So, yeah. Yes, that's what we're talking about. Correct. Actually, this opens up a whole other question, okay, of Dina de Mechusadina, whether, you know, how this all fits with the laws of whatever land you live in, and that's a whole other discussion as well, which is a very important one. Interesting one, but not ours. We're talking about Jewish studies. And again, you know, the application to Uber would be tangential, because it's all just, what I'm trying to do is create a framework for how we think about these issues, but not necessarily practical application. A good point. Okay. So we tried to give support to Rav Huna. It was rejected. Now, we're not going to try to bring support to Rav Huna. The Gemara is now going to try to question Rav Huna in two different ways. So the Gemara says, Amar le Ravina le Rava. Ravina says to Rava, Lema Rav Huna da Amar to Rabbi Yehuda. It's possible that Rav Huna is really basing himself on an earlier opinion of a Tana named Rabbi Yehuda, which, by the way, is slightly problematic, because, as we'll see, Rabbi Yehuda is a lone opinion. And against him, you have Chachamim, who are the majority opinion. But let's see what the support is. Ditznan, we have a Mishnah in Baba Metzia, which says, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Lo yichalech chenvani klayos ve'egozim letinokos, lifnei shemargilan etzlo, v'chachamim matirim. Exactly your question from before. So Rabbi Yehuda says that a person, a storekeeper, cannot distribute candies and goodies to the children, because they're going to entice them so strongly to come to their store, they're going to prevent them from going anywhere else. That's Rabbi Yehuda's opinion. So he limits the free market, limits the advertising of this particular store, the distribution of the candy, to prevent the monopoly that this store could have over these children. And if they have the monopoly over the children, they're certainly going to have the monopoly over the parents. The Chachamim say it's okay. Okay. So how is this a question? So far, that was the question on Ravuna. Why? Okay, let's read a little more then. Okay, let's keep going and then we'll see. Okay. Afilu tema rabbanan, ad kan lo pligi rabbanan, alei de Rabbi Yehuda hasam, elo de amar le ana kamas pliginam gozi, ad plug shiuski. You suggest that Rav Huna's aligned here with Rav Yehuda because he restricts the free market enterprise in some of the ways that you guys were suggesting. No, that's not at all the case here, because even Chachamim might agree in the case of Rav Huna. Why? The only reason Chachamim disagreed over here with Rav Yehuda is because one storekeeper could say to the other, hey, okay, I'm distributing candy, so you can distribute candy too. I'm distributing walnuts, you distribute almonds, distribute whatever you want. The children could choose where to go. No one's restricted in terms of how they advertise when you have two stores and how you grab your customers in. So in this case, Chachamim would permit it, because anybody can advertise in the way they want. But in our case, perhaps Chachamim would restrict it as well, because in our case, it's not an issue of how you're advertising, it's an issue of a new business coming in and taking away from an existing business, rather than two existing businesses which could advertise in different ways. Everyone see the difference? So the Gemara rejects the question of Rav Huna. Gemara says, hey, doesn't Rav Huna align with one lone opinion of Rabbi Yehuda? Gemara says, no. Perhaps you could align even with the opinion of the Chachamim over here, that even the Chachamim would restrict the free market in the case that Rav Huna was speaking about. Okay, let's keep going. Question number two, just in terms of the structure of the Gemara, people have different backgrounds in Gemara, but just to be clear, so we had a statement of Rav Huna. We're always dealing with the statement. We had a potential support for his statement, and we rejected it. We had a potential question on his statement, and now we rejected it. Now we're going to have another potential question on Rav Huna as well. Meisve, we have an objection to Rav Huna from a Braisa. Braisa says as follows, Ose Adam Chanus Vesad Chanus Shel Chavero, a person's allowed to open up a store right next to the store of someone else. Umerchas Vesad Merchas Shel Chavero, they can open a bathhouse next to the other guy's bathhouse. Ve'eno Yachol Limchos Biyado, and they can't protest the opening of the other store right next door. Mifnei Yachol Lo Marlo, Atau Sebetov Shelcha, V'Anio Sebetov Sheli. We're all doing our own thing. I don't have a monopoly just because I was here first. You open your store, you do your thing. I open my store, I do my thing, and therefore no restriction to the free market environment. Okay, so you see how this is an objection to Rav Huna. Rav Huna limits the free market. This particular Braisa says open market. Whoever wants to come in, comes in and does what they want. So the answer, the way we reject this question, the Gemara says, Tanaihi, not so fast. The opinion brought in this Braisa, which says one store can open next to the other, is one Tanaitic opinion, one opinion of the Tanaim. But this was actually a Machlokas Tanaim. It was a debate between the earlier authorities, the rabbis of the Mishnah. So this particular Braisa, which we just saw, only brought one opinion. But I'm going to bring another Braisa, says the Gemara, which has the opposite opinion as well, and that opposite opinion will not be counter to Rav Huna, but actually support him, which means that you can't use one opinion of a Tana to reject Rav Huna when Rav Huna is really agreeing with a different Tana. Normally, if you have the opinion of a Tana, which was a lone opinion, which was the only opinion, and you have a later authority, an Amora, who says differently, then you could trump the later authority, the Amora, by the statement of the Tana.
But if it's already a machlokes tanaim, it's a debate between the tanaim, and the hun is still siding with one of them, then you can't reject it based on the opinion of the other tana. This tanya, we have a different braisa, which says the following. This is very important for us. Kofin b'nei mavos, ze'ed ze'ed, shelo lehoshiv b'neihem, lo chayat, v'lo bursiki, v'lo melamed tinokos, v'lo echad mizne'i bale umnios. So different members of the mavoi, the alleyway, right, we showed the diagram before, of this little neighborhood, can prevent each other from bringing in from the outside another tailor or another tanner or another teacher or any other craftsman that might compete with a local craftsman that's already there. Ulishcheno eino kofeinu. But they can't prevent each other from going into the same field. So the first time now we see a distinction in this opinion of the Tana Kam over here in this Raisa between outsiders and insiders in terms of competition. So what the Tana Kam is suggesting is that we don't limit the market when it has to do with the members of the Mabui itself, but we do limit the market and competition from people from the outside that might compete with the local. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, Ask Lishcheno Kofeyu. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel disagrees with the Tana Kama, the first opinion here, and he says you can even prevent locals from opening up shop next door to you. So, which opinion sides with Rav Huna? Which opinion sides with Rav Huna? Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel and the Tana Kama here are debating whether you allow free market with neighbors or not. So Rav Shimon ben Gamliel says you don't allow a free market with outsiders, you don't allow a free market with insiders, and therefore that's the opinion of Rav Huna. So even though the Tana Kama, who says with locals you don't restrict business, and that opinion rejects Rav Huna, we have support for Rav Huna from Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. Okay. Let's just finish this Gemara and then we'll wrap this piece up. Amar Rav Huna Breda Rav Yeshua, Rav Huna Breda Rav Yeshua comments on this, and he says, Pshita li, bar masa, a bar masa achriti, mati miyakev. Vishayach, becharga, dehacha, lo mati miyakev. It seems, therefore, that members of one city to another city could prevent each other from coming in, unless, of course, the member of the other city wants to pay the poll tax in this city, and then they could be considered a member of this city itself. That's clear to me, says Rav Huna Breda Rav Yehoshua, commenting on the opinion of the Tana Kama, which we just saw. Second point, bar mavua, bar mavua de nafse lo masiniyake. Clearly, people of the same neighborhood cannot prevent each other from opening businesses. But he had one question. Bar Rav Huna Breda Rav Yehoshua, bar mavua, huina mai. What happens within one mavui? Can they prevent each other from opening or not? And the Gemara ends with a teku. So you have three different levels here in the Rav Huna Breda Rav Yehoshua. A little confusing here because the first opinion we saw was Rav Huna. Now we see another Rav Huna. There's two different Rav Hunas, but two generations apart. Let me summarize where we've come in this Gemara and then we'll pull it all together. Essentially, what we've seen in the end of the Gemara here is two opinions. The opinion of Rav Huna, the original Rav Huna, who's restrictive in terms of competition, and the opinion of Rav Huna Breda Rav Yehoshua, we'll call him Rav Huna number two, who's more permissive in terms of competition, who draws the distinction between local competition and outside competition, and says there's free reign. Anybody can open up stores locally, but someone coming from the outside cannot unless they pay the poll tax. Okay. So Tosfos actually says, look at the next page here. Tosfos says very clear that we paskin like the second opinion of Huna Breda Rav Yehoshua, which basically is the more permissive view, which allows for competition between locals, but not for outsiders. And he says it for two reasons. Number one, because Rav Huna Breda Rav Yehoshua is actually siding with the earlier Tanaitic opinion of the Chachamim, which is the majority opinion, as opposed to Rav Huna, the original Rav Huna, which is siding with Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, which is a lone opinion. So that's always a stronger case in Halacha. Secondly, Rav Huna Breda Yehoshua, Rav Huna number two, is the later authority within the same time period. So in the time period of the Amoraim, Rav Huna number two comes later. And we generally side with later authorities within one time period rather than the earlier one. So Tosfos follows that, as do most of the Rishonim. If you look at the Shulchan Aruch on the next page, Shulchan Aruch follows this opinion as well.
You don't have to look at it now, but maybe if we have time later, we'll come back. So Chanarach follows the opinion of Tosfos, follows the opinion of Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Huna, number two, telling us that we do not restrict enterprise within one locality, within one city. Okay, let's come back to Uber now and discuss. I want to make four points that come out of the discussions of this Gemara that I think pertain to Uber and can give us a framework to think about it. Essentially, what we've seen is that the halacha supports the free market within a town, but not necessarily between towns. So when it comes to Uber, one of the most difficult questions to deal with is who is Uber, what is Uber, and where is it located? If indeed we're postulating that the essential difference in terms of free market or restricted market is local versus non-local, then how do you even define that in the case of Uber? Is Uber a company from California? Is it a public company? Is it a company that's located in each particular city? How exactly do you define the parameters of Uber? Actually, if you look in source number 5, saw in Wikipedia that one of the difficulties governments are having in restricting Uber is because of this issue of jurisdiction as well. Since most of Uber happens over the internet, it's hard to actually pinpoint whose jurisdiction it's under. Governments, or maybe the driver, right? Governments have largely been unable to stop Uber's operations in their jurisdictions because its operations are conducted primarily over the internet. At city jurisdictions, this might be easier to achieve. So you see that this is an issue. So I actually, there's in Rabbi Jaster, Howard Jaster, I don't know if you know who he is, very fine person, lives in Phoenix, Rabbi Vishul, also teaches in TABC in Phoenix. I think in one of his volumes of Gray Matter, his sefer on different halachic topics, he has discussions of Hasagas Gvul, and I saw in there once that he has a psak from one of the rabbinical courts in Tel Aviv that speaks. I tried to look for it actually this morning. I couldn't find it. So if someone has it or knows of it, you can show it to me. But I think if I remember correctly, Rabbi Gasser was quoting this stock from the Beit Din in Tel Aviv about whether they could restrict the market of insurance agents. And they had determined that insurance agents don't operate locally, or you can't distinguish between local and non-local. They're not really a neighborhood-based industry. They're more of a global industry, more of an industry that happens over the internet. And so actually that basin said that you could not distinguish between local and local. Something that's global would just be considered like a local, not necessarily like someone from the outside. So it's very hard to pinpoint exactly where to place these things. So if you think about it in the context of Uber, if Uber happens over the internet, then you can't necessarily make the divide and say, well, Uber's from the outside. It's coming in to attack our local business. You can't make that distinction. And therefore, they could be, in theory, treated like a local business, which, according to the stock that we have, Tosfos following the second Rav Huna, you do not restrict competition of locals, and therefore it would not be restricted. But second point, there's still something else to consider. Even if Uber could be considered a local, and therefore you can't restrict the competition between them, does halacha really allow for all forms of competition locally, or are there limits to that as well? So there are some very interesting discussions for this. You might distinguish between regular competition and what we would call ruinous competition. Competition that's so severe that it would absolutely destroy the other business. So actually, the Beis Yosef here in source number 7 quotes the Mordechai. Mordechai is a 13th century German rabbi. He was one of the Talmidim, one of the students of the Maharal Rami Wittenberg. Very interesting personality. He was killed in the Rheinfleisch massacres, actually, very sadly, in the late 1200s. But he writes here, quotes from an earlier authority called the Avi Asaf, that if you have a case of a mavoi, it's a very interesting case, a mavoi, an alleyway that's closed on three sides. It's not an open alleyway. And you have one guy whose business is at the end of the dead end of the alleyway. And someone else opens a business at the entry to the alleyway, so that everybody coming in has to pass that business. Then even though we paskin, Shulchan Aruch, later paskin, but even, you know, Tosfos earlier was shown in paskin, that within a mavoi you can't restrict competition, the Mordechai says in this case you can. You know why? Because no one is ever going to get to the other guy's store. This would be a level of competition that would be too severe. This would be ruinous
competition, and therefore we would restrict it. So coming back to Uber now, and many others follow this. I actually, if you're interested later, Moshe has a fascinating tshuva about this. You could only understand this tshuva, Moshe, if you're from Brooklyn. But he says one Rebbe opened a shtiebel, and then you know he paid for it himself, and then another Rebbe opened a different shtiebel, and everybody started to go there. And the first Rebbe brought a case against the second one that they was ruinous competition, that all the people were going there, and now he couldn't pay for the house, etc., etc. So Rav Moshe, others follow in this path that do restrict even local competition if it happens to be so severe that it's ruinous. So if you look at Uber, the taxi drivers in New York are claiming that this is not just competition, this is actually a level of ruinous competition. So perhaps you would say, according to halacha, according to Jewish ethics, that you would be able to restrict such competition. If you think about it, we don't have time now, I don't want to take too much of your time, but think about the fish case again and how this relates to ruinous competition. No one, now the Shulchan Aruch, the Rambam quotes the fish case of our Gemara, but to me, the fish case is a case of ruinous competition as well. A little bit different than the ones we're talking about, but you could think about how that would apply as well. Next point, the third point about Uber that I want to make. I just said that perhaps Uber can't be treated as an outsider, maybe it's local. On the flip side, maybe even if it's local, it's ruinous competition, so it should be restricted. Keep going back and forth here. But, third point, halacha doesn't only protect the businesses, halacha also comes to protect the consumers. There's a fantastic Mimuke Yosef, look at the next page, verse number 9, the Mimuke Yosef, Yosef ibn Khadir in the 14th century, quotes the Machlokas here, discussion actually, between the Rimi Gash and the Ramban. The Rimi Gash, of Yosef ibn Migash, 12th century, was a teacher, he was a student of the Rif, the teacher of the Rambam's father, a very important personality. Quotes the Rimi Gash, who says that even though we don't restrict We do restrict outside competition from coming in cases where the outside competition coming in is able to offer lower prices to the consumers, then you would allow them in, allowing them to compete with the locals. Why? Because even though it might be competition to the other businesses, it's positive for the consumer. So there's a balance of values here between protection of the consumer and protection of the business owner, which opens up a whole other discussion about Uber. If Uber is offering fares that are significantly better than taxis, benefiting the consumer, and actually offering a service to the customers, if the Ramah quotes this in Shulchan Aruch, hold on, one thing. The Ramah quotes this in Shulchan Aruch, actually, and the Rama adds that not only in cases where there would be cheaper would we allow them in from the outside, but also where they offer a good or a service that wasn't all offered locally, that was a little bit different than what was offered locally. So if you look at it through that lens, perhaps Uber's offering something that people couldn't get before, couldn't get at that price before, and so you might say now that Uber should be permitted. Yes. There is. There's a lot of lines to draw here. Obviously, you have to go into much more detail about it. But yeah, one more question, and then I want to go to my last point, and we can wrap up. No, actually, taxis can use Uber as well. There's an Uber taxi where you don't necessarily. Correct me if I'm wrong, I've never done this, but if some of you have, you can correct me. I think when you do Uber Taxi, you get the rates that the taxi charges, but you can get it through Uber or something like that. So it's some combination, actually, that might be an interesting solution. Let me just make one more point. We won't look at it inside, but it's source number 10. If you have a chance to look at it, the tshuva of the Sholem Eshev, of Yosef Sholem Eshenstein, who was a rabbi in Lemberg in the 19th century. And he has a great, great tshuva here, which I think is so applicable. This is the final point I'll make about Uber, which is extremely applicable to Uber. He says, what happens if two locals, right? Remember, we're postulating that locals can compete with each other. We don't restrict the competition unless perhaps it's ruinous. Locals can compete. But, he says, what happens if the locals are engaged in a business that they require a license from the government in order to operate? And one person legally obtained that license, and one person is illegally operating their business because they didn't obtain the license. Then,
then, oh, so he addresses that. Can you blow the whistle to the non-Jewish government about this? But even subsequent to that, who has a claim here over who? If the legal obtainer of the license sees now that the other guy illegally is operating without the license, does he have a claim against him? So he makes a very interesting distinction. He says it might depend on why the government issues these licenses and why the person that is operating illegally didn't get the license. Are the licenses meant to limit the amount of sellers, to limit the competition of the city? If that's the case, then perhaps the legal operating business has a claim against the illegally operating business for diminishing Parnassa. He's taking away some of his business because he's operating without a license. He may not have been granted the license. He may have not have been able to compete with the original business who had obtained the license. But Rav Nathanson says, what happens if it's not about restricting business, but it's just to regulate the market, regulate the field? What happens then? In that case, perhaps the cost of the license was so great that the illegal guy who's operating without the license didn't want to absorb that cost. And now, because of that, the guy who operates legally has to charge so much more that the illegal guy is actually offering ruinous competition to the guy that obtained it legally. In which case, you revert back to what we said about ruinous competition. So if you think about it in the context of Uber, it's really the article I showed you before about the taxi industry. If taxi industries are regulated and you're supposed to obtain a medallion, you're supposed to obtain a license, then can Uber come in and do this in an unrestricted manner, and would have taxi claims have a claim against them? The case that's being brought last week in New York is exactly very, very similar to the case of Rav Nathanson. So let me just sum up exactly where we've come from. At the end of the day, I think you see the halacha has a very balanced view in many ways, allowing for a free market, but still protecting both consumers and businesses in a variety of ways, placing certain limitations upon the free market, basically to prevent complete ruination of another business, and to be able to enable customers to be able to have choices and to be able to have competition that's positive for them. There's much, much more to say about this, and there are so many angles that we haven't even touched upon, including the employee-contractor one. But I think what I would say is that I hope I've piqued your interest to thinking more about these topics and giving you a lens to think about some of the issues that arise with Uber, and I hope you've enjoyed this year today. I think we can take a couple of questions.
Who
owns
Uber?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Wow.
We don't debate, it's a foul debate between the coming and the opponent. But we can debate with the
team. Yeah, that's true. Okay, please correct us.
It is, in fact, New York City is an extreme example of New York that gets a lot of publicity. It's not Maryland. Maryland is more typical than the rest of the United States.
Okay.
Taxi cabs are regulated by municipalities and the county towns, effectively, the municipalities. Limousines are regulated by the state.
Okay.
You need to make a distinction in Uber between Uber Black, Uber SUV, and Uber X. Uber Black and Uber SUV were always legal in the state of Maryland. Uber X was not. Why not? This is something we didn't get into. They did not have full insurance.
Right. That is.
In terms of span of coverage, not amount. Their vehicles are not inspected.
Mm-hmm.
Their drivers are not vetted.
Right.
Which is all true for limousine drivers and municipalities in Maryland protect their drivers. This year, partly because of the public response to Uber broadly, law was passed in Maryland. Governor Simon can do. Uber has a year to come into compliance, and the new category is created. Not limousine, not taxi, but TNC, transportation network company. Because Uber contends they're not a transportation company, they're a facilitator, not a company.
Right. Fascinating.
The jury is still out because we're going to comply. We're going to comply. And we'll know next spring if they did, because the Public Service Commission was given the COVID plan to come up with regulations dealing with Uber X. And the county responded by sending it to the county that COVID, which isn't, in some respects, as protective as it has been. On the other hand, it's still quite safe. The key is dealing with an entity that actually has placed someone in personal jeopardy. You will not find, except through a system of craft, a taxi driver or a limousine driver locally who has a felony on his record.
Right. You're raising some incredibly important...
There was a fatality in San Francisco created by an Uber vehicle.
Yes.
That was improperly insured.
There's been a number of... I think you're absolutely right. You're raising so many fascinating points, and I didn't know that's what you did, so we'll have to have more of a discussion. That's an angle we didn't even touch upon, which many people object to, not the competition angle, but the various dangers that are posed. I think if there's other questions, we can take them afterwards. Thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Rabbi Weinberg again.